from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the Thai military launches a coup. Explosions in a busy Chinese market leave 31 people dead.
These were Molotov cocktails that they were throwing into the crowd.
Two nations block a resolution referring alleged Syrian abuses to the ICC. And the Pope's Israel visit is to highlight interfaith dialogue. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Thailand's military officially took control of the country today in a coup, 2 days after the army chief imposed martial law. As VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok, the military has detained government officials and tightened media restrictions.
Thailand's army chief, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, flanked by the heads of the armed forces, announced the coup in an address carried on all major television stations Thursday afternoon and declared the military and police are now running the kingdom's government. The general says it is necessary for the military and police to take control of governing the country. He says the army will restore order and push through political reform. The military says the country's new ruling body is the National Peace and Order Maintaining Council, headed by the army chief. Following the coup announcement, the military detained senior officials in the caretaker government, as well as leaders of rival political factions. The military later ordered remaining members of the caretaker cabinet, including the acting prime minister, to turn themselves in to the main army office in Bangkok. Soldiers moved in to clear the two main rally sites, where both pro- and anti-government demonstrators have held rallies in recent days. They dispersed crowds and detained several leaders. The military also announced a nationwide curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. All domestic television and radio stations have been ordered to suspend their programming. Foreign news broadcasts were also cut. Internet service appeared unaffected. The pro-government Red Shirts left their rally site on the outskirts of Bangkok, but on social media they were defiant. A Twitter message from the United Front for Democracy Against Dictatorship warned to stand by for retaliation. At the anti-government rally site, many protesters welcomed the coup, saying it is a final step in removing their political opponents from power. Thailand has now experienced 19 coups or attempted coups since 1932. Carl Thayer is a professor of politics from the University of New South Wales in Australia.
Thailand is extremely polarized. The military is not neutral. I mean, it does favor the monarchy, and this now could lead to resistance to military rule. It's like a deja vu all over again in 2006.
The military coup in 2006 led to changes in the country's constitution that were intended to set up a more stable political system. Late last year, anti-government demonstrators began their Bangkok rallies, pushing to unseat the elected government and implement more significant political reforms. 6 months later, after some 28 people were killed and 700 injured in violence connected to political protests, the army said it was taking over to end the violence. The roots of the political standoff go back years. On one side, royalists and allied groups seek to rid the country of the influence of billionaire Thaksin Shinawat, whose parties and candidates have won every election since 2001. Thaksin, a populist favored by working class and rural voters, was ousted as prime minister in the 2006 coup. He now lives in self-imposed exile to avoid a prison sentence for a corruption conviction. He and his supporters called the charges politically motivated. The leader of the People's Democratic Reform Movement, former Deputy Prime Minister Suthep Thaugsuban, had launched repeated final battles from rally stages to bring down the Thaksin-allied government. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Chinese state media say a bomb attack has killed 31 people at a busy market in the capital of the ethnically divided Xinjiang region. The official Xinhua news agency says more than 90 people were injured. VOA correspondent Bill Ide spoke with us from Beijing about the raid.
Well, from what we understand, the attackers were driving two cars. It sounds like a Jeep or a cross-country vehicle is what they're calling it, and were throwing bombs. From the pictures, it seems like these were Molotov cocktails that they were throwing into the crowds. And so as they went down this street, which is normally blocked off, and not open to traffic. Residents there were run over, and some were also killed from the bomb blast.
Is there enough assistance there to help these people, the ones that survived?
From what we know at this point, there's plenty of help, and the recovery has been swift in response to what has happened.
Do we know who is responsible for this?
At this point, we don't know who is responsible or who might have been behind the attacks. This is not the first, though, in recent months, and there has been an increase of attacks that have been occurring in public spaces across China, and most of those, or two of those up to this point, have been blamed on religious extremists. It is very likely that this attack also will be blamed on religious extremists as well.
This area is the home to the mainly Muslim Uyghur minority group. Is that the people that you're referring to?
Yes. When I say religious extremists, up to this point, typically it has been those who are, these kinds of attacks have been blamed on people who are members of Xinjiang's minority group called the Uyghurs. They're mainly Muslim minority group, and the government says that they, over in recent years, have been, religious extremism has been growing in the area, and they have been blamed for many of these types of attacks. That said, at the same time, rights groups also frequently talk about the problems that minorities in Xinjiang are facing, and that these attacks, while horrible, are also possibly the result of government policies or strong reaction to what some may feel is the government's oppressive approach to minorities in the region.
What is the government's response to today's attack?
The government, of course, has condemned the attack and called on the international community to condemn the attack as well. It's also said that it expressed its confidence that it can handle this problem, that it can take on the problem of terrorism in China, and that it's capable. That's an interesting statement to make, because there have been a number of attacks in recent months. The most, the one before this was late last month, and it occurred a day also in Urumqi, and it occurred a day after the president had visited the city. So some have asked the question of, you know, whether the government is doing enough, or whether its approach up to this point is effective. The government is in the midst of a massive crackdown on terrorism in China. Security has been heightened at train stations, and particularly in the rest of region of Xinjiang. So I think while the government is expressing its confidence that it will address this problem and indeed will continue to take a hard approach, there will be questions, I believe, about how effective it has been up to this point.
VOA correspondent Bill Ide speaking with us from Beijing.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Russia and China have vetoed a UN Security Council resolution to refer the situation in Syria to the International Criminal Court. This is the fourth time the two countries have used their veto power to block Security Council action targeting Syria since the conflict there began in March 2011. The French-drafted resolution condemned widespread violations of human rights by Syrian authorities and pro-government militias, as well as abuses by non-state armed groups. More than 50 other nations signed on as co-sponsors of the measure. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, says the outcome of today's vote will not end the pursuit of justice in Syria.
My government will continue to work with so many other governments and organizations to encourage and facilitate the further gathering of evidence. There is no limit to our determination to see that the victims of atrocities in Syria and their loved ones receive answers in accordance with the majesty of law. In this quest, we will be guided by a fundamental principle of civilization, a principle that has truly stood the test of time. And I quote, "Those who are not wronged, no less than those who are wronged, must exert themselves to punish the wrongdoers," end quote. So said Solon, the Athenian sage, more than 2,500 years ago, and so affirmed the overwhelming majority of this council today.
The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, speaking today after the vote on Syria. On Wednesday, Russia's ambassador to the U.N., Vitaly Churkin, described the resolution as a publicity stunt, saying it would complicate the goal of finding a political solution to the crisis. Russia is one of the five permanent members of the Security Council. Each member has the ability to stop a resolution or decision by voting against it. Syria is not a part of the treaty that created the International Criminal Court, so a Security Council resolution is the only way for ICC prosecutors in The Hague to investigate the alleged abuses. Physicians for Human Rights, a New York-based advocacy organization, is highly critical of Russia and China for refusing to refer the Syrian crisis to the ICC. Shortly after today's vote, we asked spokeswoman Whitney Brown her reaction.
It is a complete betrayal of civilians in Syria that are suffering. There's a lack of justice and accountability for those who are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Syria, and it's civilians who are bearing the brunt, and that Russia and China would veto something that would start the engines of justice working is unacceptable.
Could you tell us some of the specifics you're aware of that have happened in Syria?
Well, as Physicians for Human Rights, we're focused primarily on the assaults on the hospitals, clinics, and the detention and torture and killing of doctors. We actually have documented 150 attacks on hospitals that were deliberate, intentional. Each one of those attacks is a war crime, and taken together, they constitute a crime against humanity.
Could you tell me any specific stories?
Yes, for instance, as you probably know, there's a UN Security Council resolution trying to get aid into the country to the civilians in the besieged areas. One of the only things that the government's letting through are polio vaccines because there's been an outbreak of polio, and yet they have bombed the clinic and killed a doctor who is actually trying to vaccinate children. In targeting a polio clinic, what you know you're going to do is kill children.
I take it today's vote is not going to dampen your organization's fight for justice.
Justice, as we know, often is very long in coming, and justice delayed sometimes is justice denied, but we absolutely must keep pushing for this because otherwise there's the risk that the assault on civilians, the assault on the medical system, the besieging of civilians in Syria will become the new normal.
Whitney Brown, Director of Programs at Physicians for Human Rights. Meanwhile, Syrian activists say government troops backed by airstrikes have broken a year-long rebel siege of a prison in the northern city of Aleppo. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said Syrian forces entered the prison complex early today, days after launching a push to dislodge opposition fighters. It said areas around the prison were heavily shelled. The rebels surrounding the site had repeatedly attacked the prison, hoping to free the detainees being held there. National parliamentary elections are set to be held in Libya this June. The announcement comes after days of clashes between government forces and those loyal to rogue general Khalifa Haftar. At least 70 people have died since last Friday. David Mack is a scholar with the Middle East Institute and a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy asked him for his assessment of the conflict in Libya.
I think that there is considerable exaggeration about the depth of the movement that was announced by General Khalifa Haftar. It's not at all apparent that he is really working in coordination with the Zintan militias, for example, that are responsible for what took place in Tripoli, even though he has tended to try to take responsibility for it.
But if General Haftar is targeting Ansar Sharia, that the United States has declared as a terrorist organization, would that be an incentive to tempt the U.S. to support his offensive?
The United States is not going to take sides in these kinds of disputes. The U.S. government position is to support stability and change through constitutional means and elections. And to the extent that Khalifa Haftar, for example, were to be engaged in that kind of activity, which is quite possible in the future, then it could be responsible and helpful. but disrupting the constitutional process, which is ongoing, is not something that the U.S. government would really want to see.
What are the U.S. options in Libya at a time when critics of the Obama administration have argued that the United States should exercise more assertive leadership in Libya?
Well, the United States is going to continue to work with a broad international coalition, including allies in Europe and in the Arab world. There recently were meetings in Rome of the Friends of Libya to talk about practical ways of providing support. It's known that the United States is prepared to assist in the training and equipping of Libyan personnel for a general purpose force. This is something that has been requested by the government in Tripoli, and modalities for doing that are being worked out. That would go along with training that's been provided by Italy and Turkey, and for which the United Kingdom has also offered to provide assistance. The United States is also very supportive of the role of the United Nations as a key coordinating element for the process of constitutional change and future elections. The Libyans have shown that they are able to have elections, and they are in the process of drafting their constitution with an elected body meeting to do that draft. We're very supportive of the activities of the very substantial United Nations presence on the ground there to help them do that.
But you are not recommending any direct involvement of the U.S. in Libya now?
No, I'm certainly not recommending a direct U.S. military involvement in Libya. I think that the kind of military support that the United States has provided in the past to the Libyan forces, so for example, for the collection and disposal of weapons, including chemical weapons, is highly desirable, as is the training of Libyan forces. But if you're talking about some kind of unilateral U.S. military mission on the ground, sending in forces or operations against this or that political actor, that's not anything I would be recommending.
David Mack, a scholar with the Middle East Institute and a former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Middle East. Libya has endured unrest since longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi was removed from power in 2011.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
President Obama has deployed 80 U.S. military personnel to Chad to help find more than 250 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants last month in neighboring Nigeria. The Pentagon said the deployment will consist largely of Air Force personnel operating an unmanned, unarmed drone from a site inside Chad. State Department officials and federal investigators are also aiding in the search. The girls were abducted by Boko Haram militants April 14th from a boarding school in a remote area close to Nigeria's border with Cameroon, Niger, and Chad. Their whereabouts remain unknown. In a VOA interview, Ruben Abati, an aide to President Goodluck Jonathan, said intelligence reports show that Boko Haram has ties to Al-Qaeda, Somalia-based Al-Shabaab, and other terrorist groups.
The objective is to destabilize Nigeria, destabilize West Africa, and target other countries. And the activities of that group are shown very clearly that this is a group that constitutes a threat to our civilization. This is a group that constitutes a threat to democracy. This is a group that constitutes a threat to our common humanity and the bonds that tie us together.
President Jonathan has said publicly many times he is fully committed to winning the war on terrorism. Suspected Islamist militants have killed nearly 30 people in two villages near Chibok, the northern Nigerian town where the schoolgirls were kidnapped last month. Meanwhile, survivors of Tuesday's twin bombings in the city of Jos are telling their stories. The blasts in a busy market area killed at least 118 people. Franklin Anderson spoke with reporters from a hospital in Jos, where she's being treated for burns over much of her body.
I don't know what happened. I just found myself in the fire. Everywhere was dark. I was rolling in that fire, and I just don't know. I didn't know it was real at first. So when I realized pains that I was burning in the fire, and I said, no, I can't die here.
Dr. Edmund Benoit is the chief medical director at the Jos University Teaching Hospital.
Some are very critical. We received injuries that range from traumatic amputation, fractures, abdominal injuries that will let out intestines, and chest injuries. So some of them are really very critical.
No one has claimed responsibility for the blast and resulting fire in Jos, but suspicion immediately fell on Boko Haram. Let's change the subject. Pope Francis is to visit the Holy Land for the first time since he became head of the Roman Catholic Church 14 months ago. In addition to stops in Jordan and Bethlehem, the Pope will visit Jerusalem, one of Christianity's holiest sites. VOA Scott Bob reports.
The Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem's Old City. This marks the site where Christians believe Jesus Christ was crucified and rose from the dead more than 2,000 years ago. Pilgrims visit from all over the world. Derry Sullivan from Ireland.
Very emotional coming to see the religious sites. I find it emotional anyway, I must say.
The Pope is to meet the head of the Greek Orthodox Church here. This is to mark a similar encounter 50 years ago that launched a dialogue between the two churches after centuries of conflict. A coordinator of the visit, Vicar David Neuhaus, says reconciliation is important not only to Catholics and Orthodox Christians.
This is one of the terrible wounds on the face of the church, but this is also an opening to bring all Christians together, Eastern and Western, Protestants, Catholics and Orthodox and the ancient churches of the East, to say it's enough. The Lord asked very deliberately that we be one.
Ursula Vega is visiting with two friends from Spain. Lucia Riñón is hopeful.
I think very important steps are being taken. Benedict XVI and John Paul II made some. But I think Pope Francis is going to advance it more. I have confidence it will happen. The will is there.
The Pope during his visit is to meet the senior Muslim leader and two chief rabbis of Jerusalem. Father Neuhaus says this underscores his deep ties to both communities.
He has a deep personal commitment to relations with the Jews, and therefore, just as intimately, we are also profoundly linked to the Palestinian people. And here is the delicacy. Coming into a region where the joy of one is the disaster of the other, and the disaster of one is the joy of the other, the Pope is coming as a profound friend of both.
He says the pontiff will also visit the Holocaust Museum and refugees from various conflicts in the region to show his concern for the suffering of all human beings. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
New U.S. Census statistics released today show that cities in the southwest of the United States are growing faster than most other areas, with the area including the Texas capital, Austin, showing the largest municipal population growth in the country last year. The population within the Austin city limits grew by nearly 21,000 people in 2013, but most of the area's growth came in three municipalities on the outskirts of the Texas capital, San Marcos, Cedar Park, and Georgetown, that were each among the 10 fastest-growing cities in the country. Seven of the 15 fastest-growing cities were in Texas. The census found the list of largest cities in the U.S. was largely unchanged in 2013, with New York City, Los Angeles, and Chicago topping the list. The total population is currently estimated at just more than 318 million. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.